I interviewed the president first, and you know, I spent about an hour sweating in a park across from the White House, thinking, can't believe I'm going in there to talk to the president of the United States. I mean, I've interviewed a ton of celebrities in my life, but nobody's a celebrity like the president is.
Welcome to Not in a Huff with Jackson Huff, where we interview newsmakers, storytellers, and all-around interesting people. Sit back, relax, unless you're driving, and enjoy the show. Here's Jackson.
Hello, hello, hello. I am Jackson Huff. This is Not in a Huff. Thanks so much for joining me. As always, really appreciate it. This week, speaking with Peter Moore. Now, Peter is an amazing guy. You know, I had him on mainly to talk about travel. I've had a lot of travelers on before. He's been to a lot of really, really amazing places. He kind of specializes in backpacking. He actually was a editor for Backpacker Magazine. So, great guy to talk to about travel. As I told him, I had someone on who did a lot of hiking and backpacking on the West Coast in Oregon and Washington. I had on early on in the podcast somebody who had hiked the entire Appalachian Trail, which is on the East Coast. So him based in Colorado, I thought this would be a great person to talk about the middle of the country, to kind of meet in the middle there. And he certainly did talk about that. But I'll tell you, this conversation gets really, really awesome, because what I didn't really know ahead of time is that he used to be the editor of Men's Health Magazine. So we talked about some of the travels that he's done because of that. He went to India and traveled with Matt Damon. And then we talked about him and his interviews he's done for Men's Health Magazine with former President Obama and Michelle Obama. We talked all about just what that was like going to the White House and interviewing the what was the current president. Really, really awesome. Obviously, that is quite the experience. No matter what your political leanings are, to be able to go into the White House to interview a president is really cool. We're going to talk about, like I said, travel, his experiences interviewing some of the coolest people out there when it comes to just fame level. We're going to talk about his new passion, that is in being a cartoonist. He still writes articles, but he includes pictures that he's drawn along with those to supplement what he's writing. So I really, really think you're going to enjoy this one. I really, really enjoyed speaking with Peter. Here is Peter Moore. Mr. Moore, how are you?
I'm doing great, thanks. How about you?
I'm good. I'm going to let you do the heavy lifting right out the gate. Just introduce yourself.
Well, my name is Peter Moore, and I'm a writer and cartoonist. I live in Fort Collins, Colorado, and I come out of a long career as a magazine and book writer and editor.
I love it. We're going to unpack all that for sure. And I want to kind of start, the big thing we're going to talk about today is your travels. You've done a lot of that, and then your journalism career. Tell us how you got involved in both before we kind of unpack some of the cool things you've done in them both.
Yeah, my dad was devoted to the National Geographic. It was the first magazine that I ever read. You know, even before I could read, I was looking at the photographs in Nat Geo. And my dad would be reading National Geographic and say, I want to go there. And that's how we ended up touring Switzerland and two Volkswagen Beetles when I was... I had a big family, four brothers, mom and dad, traveled around Switzerland and France and Italy in these two Volkswagen Beetles. You know, we were always going off on adventures to the Grand Canyon, to Cape Cod, Nantucket. So I was, you know, raised as a traveler. You know, even when I was probably 6 years old, we drove from Connecticut to Wyoming, which took us 3 days. And I was vomiting most of the way because I was facing backward in the station wagon that we had at the time. But even vomiting all the way to Wyoming, I still thought it was super cool to arrive at Yellowstone. So, I guess you could say travel has been in my blood. My journalism career came about. I was an English major in college, if you can believe that, you know, back in the day when you could be an English major and, you know, still expect to have a good life. But early on, I decided that, you know, I just felt like I needed to make some money and have a legit career rather than, you know, sitting alone in my room and working on bad novels. So right after I graduated, my dad had a contact for me with a with an editor who was working on a project about American history, and he needed somebody, me, to write American history in 100, 250 word bursts. And that was how I began my career as a writer and editor. And, you know, I soon jumped into magazines and, you know, worked for some very large legendary magazines like Playboy and Men's Health and Backpacker. So, you know, it's been a great career and I'm very grateful to have had it. You know, I always say that working as a writer and editor is like the career equivalent of a liberal arts education. You're always learning something new.
I think that's awesome. And I love that, you know, the passion came from National Geographic. I feel like I've talked to a lot of travelers and I feel like everyone mentions that at some point. Actually, a few weeks ago, I interviewed a guy who had been to 100 plus countries. And his other kind of side thing was that he collects National Geographic. And, you know, he showed me on camera that he has issue number one almost through the whole thing. So I feel like that sparked a lot of people's interest in travel, that National Geographic magazine, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it shrinks the world for you. It brings it to your doorstep once a month. I love Nat Geo. And, you know, I can remember one time my dad was reading about whales. And that's how we, you know, like what family actually goes to the country of Wales? But we were staying in a hotel on the, you know, on the oceanfront in Wales, traveling around. You know, my dad recited Crossing the Bar, Alfred Lord Tennyson's poem that was that he wrote when he was staying in Barmouth. That's the kind of full rap cultural experience I would get. I got out of being my dad's son.
Yeah, well, I got a different experience with whales and the other kind of whales when I'm seeing National Geographic and seeing, you know, whales on the cover there made me want to go somewhere where I could see, you know, do a whale watching tour. So that sent me to Iceland like 5 years ago. So we both have different whales that we've tried to go see, right?
Yeah, well, I've seen them off of the tip of Cape Cod. I've seen them off of Nantucket. You know, and there's all those Nathaniel Philbrick books that talk about whaling and the history of that. I'm a big fan of those books as well. So I'm with you on the whale watch.
I like it. And I want to kind of talk about, you talked about how you've written for Backpacker magazine. So you've got at least a little bit of interest in the world of hiking. And I thought you may, and I should have asked you beforehand because this may not go as well, but you may have kind of that perfect middle ground, because I've talked to two people that have done big hikes. I talked to someone who did the entire Appalachian Trail. So we're talking East Coast. I talked to somebody who did like a trail from California to Washington. So I've got West Coast. I know you've done a lot of riding like in Colorado. So if you're split in the middle and doing a lot of your backpacking in like Colorado, then it's perfect. But I don't know if that's the case.
I'm your perfect guest. I've done a ton of hiking trips. I'm kind of an expert, if you would allow me to say that, about the 10th Mountain Division huts, which are a circle of 25 or 30 huts that are in, you know, the central mountainous region of Colorado. And it's been kind of a lifelong pursuit for me to go to as many huts of those as possible. So I've done a lot of backpacking, a lot of amazing hikes in Colorado. So if you want to talk Colorado mountains, I'm right there for you.
Yeah. So what kind of hiking do you do? Are you somebody who does these day trips? Are you the really, really adventurous ones like I've talked to before that, you know, go out for weeks on end and completely rough it? What's that look like?
Hey, I'm a hiker, but I'm not crazy. I like to have a shower every couple of days. So, you know, most of my backpacking trips have been in the week or shorter variety, which is about the right length of time for me. I haven't felt any need to walk from Maine to Georgia or vice versa, but I have I've done a lot of the Appalachian Trail. I've done a lot of the Continental Divide Trail in Colorado. So I just like to be out there and then, you know, after a decent interval, go to a restaurant and then take a shower.
That makes sense. Because I feel like, you know, obviously people know about the scenery and then they know the hard parts of obviously this, the trek is difficult. So we know the good, we know potentially the bad, but there's something to be said obviously for physical activity. But the thing that when I've talked to hikers before that they really talk about is kind of just the mental health aspect of being out there. I don't know whether you travel, you hike
you know, with a large group, or you hike alone. But what have you gained when it comes to just, you know, between the ears, being able to go out and be in nature?
Well, you know, I just wrote a piece for Backpacker called "Is Death a Good Hiking Buddy?" And the idea being, how does the threat to you enhance your experience being in the great outdoors? And mostly what I was writing about and thinking about there was a 2-day hike I took to climb Long's Peak in Colorado, which is kind of a notorious peak because, you know, 3 or 4 times a year, somebody will fall off a cliff while they're climbing Long's Peak. And I was really aware while I was planning this trip that, you know, it could be my last hike. I didn't want it to be that, and my preparation matched my anxiety there. And in fact, I made it up to the top of Long's Peak. It was an amazing final 2-mile hike to get up there, because very often I was teetering on the edge of cliffs and, you know, climbing up refrigerator-sized rocks and, you know, looking down into the valley below, which was 1,000 feet below my ankles. So that kind of threat, for me, as long as I'm prepared for it, as long as I've recruited good hiking buddies, which I did on that hike, I feel like the risk involved can bring a big reward in the feeling of accomplishment that you have, but also the feeling of attentiveness you have when you're on the trail. Meaning, if I'm not very careful with these footholds and handholds, I could fall into the valley and that'd be it. And, you know, I would really not look forward to experiencing that final 5 seconds as I was hurtling toward the earth.
Yeah, I would imagine so. Yeah, I don't know if I would make the best hiker, because it took about 30 years to realize it. But, you know, I was hiking, walking along, you know, the edge of the Grand Canyon in Arizona. And I realized I got a little bit, I think I might be a little afraid of heights. So I don't know whether I can, I don't know if I would be your best hiking buddy. So don't bring me along. All right.
You know, everybody finds their challenges in life that they're suited for. I'm not an acrophobe or an agoraphobe, so being in the great outdoors is usually great for me.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk beyond hiking. Let's expand out into the entire world, and let's talk about some of your favorite travel stories. You've already talked a little bit about, you know, road tripping as a kid and going to Wales and going to Wyoming. Let's set aside some of the cool people that you've met, because we're going to get to that one here in a second, but some of your favorite travel stories.
Yeah. So when I was working at Men's Health magazine, I really, I was in a pretty good position there. You know, my work was appreciated. I was high on the masthead, so I could do pretty much whatever I wanted. So I talked my boss into letting me go to Nepal for 3 weeks. So I you know, recruited a bunch of hiking buddies and flew into Kathmandu, which, you know, it's one of those, it's just a legendary place. My whole life long, not that I knew a lot about Kathmandu, but it was like, I want to go there just because it sounds so freaking exotic. You know, I flew halfway around the world to get to Kathmandu. And then we did a trek into the mountains of Nepal. And it was called the Langtang Gosaikunda trek, meaning that the end point of one part of the trek was in Langtang. About 9 months after I got back from that trek, that was the epicenter of a huge and devastating earthquake in Nepal. So that I had just been, like, you know, through the backcountry of Nepal with an amazing guide, a group of my buddies. And, you know, and we spent a couple of days in Langtang. So I felt like, you know, going to tea houses and restaurants there and just walking around on the streets, I felt like we got to know a lot of people whose lives were about to be devastated. I haven't been back to Langtang yet, but I keep on waiting, hoping I can find a magazine that will send me there. But that was the most spectacular exotic thing I'd ever done, including getting blown around a lot by a typhoon that happened to wander onto into Nepal, even though I wasn't supposed to be there, which was a lot of misery for a lot of days. But, you know, there's something about misery that really fixes a trip in your mind. And I think of Nepal and misery and the high mountains of you know, of Nepal, all in a blur for me right now.
Yeah, well, two things to ask about that. One, I thought this trip was going to like send maybe not completely the peak of Everest, but like base camp. You didn't do all of that.
Actually, that was the original goal, was to is to go into Everest base camp, but that involves you've probably heard about the airstrip in Lukla, which is like the world's only airstrip that goes uphill, because if you can't stop the plane, you'll plunge off a cliff on the other side. It's a very dangerous airport. Mm-hmm. So we spent a couple of days waiting at the airport in Kathmandu for our flight out to Lukla. There were no flights going. It was far too dangerous. The weather was too bad to go there. So then, you know, we cooked up a different trek with our guide, and that's how I happened to go into Langtang and a lake called Gosai Kunda.
Yeah, I've heard all about that airstrip. I don't know if I call this a hiker. I call it more of a mountaineer, but I interviewed the youngest female to ever summit Mount Everest, and she talked all about that airstrip for sure. Other question when it comes to going to Kathmandu, I guess a moment of levity on that flight. How many times did you listen to the Bob Seger song?
Okay, I don't want to shock you or anything, but I don't even know the Bob Seger song about Kathmandu. So that's
really, it literally says, I'm going to Kathmandu. If I ever get out of here, that's what I'm going to do. So it would have been perfect.
Okay. Yeah. Bob Seger and me, I'll check it out. But thanks for the reminder.
You're welcome. It's only about 40 years old, so you'd had a couple chances, but you'll, I'm sure you'll listen to it now. It's almost perfect. So you got to go back now just so you can listen to the song as you're heading there.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, I listen to the song. Maybe I'll book a flight.
There you go. I want to ask you now, because, you know, I've talked to a lot of travelers and most of them won't answer this question, but you had it on your list. So apparently you're going to. What's your favorite place you've ever went?
Well, you know, I know this is a boring response, but right after I graduated from college, I didn't have any immediate plans. So I signed up for French language lessons at the Alliance Française in Paris. And, you know, it remains the most exciting, transformational destination that I ever went to, because I was, you know, just a couple months removed from walking across the stage with my, you know, diploma and my English major, no idea what I was going to do in life. And I felt like I kind of needed to hit the pause button and think, like, who am I? What does the world mean to me? What kind of jobs am I going to be looking for? I didn't want to just like jump right into some office somewhere or some job that I didn't love. I needed to figure it out a little bit. And by hitting the pause button and spending 6 months in Paris, my French got a lot better. I ate a lot of really good food. And I also, I felt more grounded, like that I'd had an adventure and I was going to use it as a springboard into an adventurous life. And Paris worked for me that way. And I still love to go back there. And, you know, I was in ecstasy while watching the opening ceremonies for the Olympics last summer, because there's so many of the places that I knew and loved in Paris. I came up on that montage of the athletes going through Paris on the River Seine. So that's my number one go-to place. I love the French language. I love French food. I'm a major cheese eater. All those things line me up as kind of a perfect tourist in France.
I love that. And you answered that one pretty easily. Let's go on the flip side. You know, I'm not going to ask you what your least favorite place you've been to, but maybe some place that you're like, I've been, I don't need to go back.
Gosh, you know, I'm a pretty appreciative traveler. Okay, I've got one for you. Everybody loves to go to Las Vegas. I don't love Vegas. It's too artificial. It's a city that's built on water that they stole from other places like Colorado. There's that whole mafia angle to it. Casinos are big, horrible places where people spend way too much money that they don't have. I don't like the whole idea of Las Vegas as a place people go to misbehave. I'm not a misbehaving person. You know, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas for me, because nothing happens in Vegas except for eat cheap food and wonder why all those people are wasting their money gambling. So that's my big negative. Vegas, you can have it.
And I'll take it because I'm going to Vegas in 10 days. I go every February, but no, I'm not the typical Vegas person. I actually, we have a family member who lives there. And so it's a really cheap trip for us because we don't pay any, we just pay to fly there. I like to collect like the $1 chip. So that sends me to all these different casinos to look at them. But I normally go for a week and I probably spend about $40 gambling. So I'm not somebody who spends a bunch of money. You can get out and go to Death Valley and we go to, you know, some of the national parks and in Utah. So there's a lot to do around there. But yeah, if you're just wasting time, not ever seeing the daylight in the casinos, I agree. It wouldn't be all that much fun.
You know, and I should say that I myself have used Las Vegas as a jumping off point for lots of adventures. That's where my family and I started, you know, a big loop that we did through the national parks, starting at the Grand Canyon and Bryce and Zion, Capitol Reef, all the you know, the big ones that you can reach easily from Vegas. But I thought it would be hilarious to, you know, have this amazing natural experience and then spend two nights in Vegas on our way out. And it was, in fact, hilarious. Both of my sons are big poker players. They weren't allowed to play in Vegas because they're too young, but they really dug the vibe of the casinos. We ate, like I said, a lot of cheap food because that's part of how Vegas runs. And it was pretty hilarious to have a entirely unnatural experience after having 2 weeks of major nature.
No, I can only imagine that for sure. Yeah, I in a much smaller scale, I did that. We went out to Death Valley one day and, you know, saw all that's to be offered there. Really, really cool place. And then we immediately came back and did a tour of the Neon Sign Museum. So from Death Valley to millions of neon lights, it was interesting. So I like that.
I like the way you travel. That sounds great.
For sure. So, you know, you mentioned one of your favorite travel memories. I've got to ask you, because you didn't mention this, but you've talked about it in some of your writing, where tell us you peed into a volcano. What's going on there?
Right after I graduated from college, I had friends who had entered the Peace Corps and they were serving in Congo. So, you know, I thought, would I ever have a better opportunity to travel in Africa than to go visit friends who were actually, you know, hunkered down in east part of Congo. So I flew to Nairobi, traveled overland with them through Uganda to get to the east part of Congo. And when we got there, everybody was abuzz because this volcano called Nyiragongo had just erupted, and it was probably 40 miles from where my friends were serving. So, you know, pretty quickly we put it on our agenda. We're going to go to Nyiragongo. So we travel there by bus. We hire a local guide. He was probably about 4 foot 5 inches tall. He was a Tutsi. I think the Tutsis are the small ones, the smaller, it's a group of people who are small in stature. This guy was, you know, was absolutely an amazing physical specimen. He carried our packs for us. He made sure that we made it back from this trip. But anyway, he set up camp for us, maybe a mile away from where the volcano was erupting. So we had our breakfast that morning, including plenty of coffee, and then walked into the volcano. And, you know, in the morning, nature calls. So, you know, I kind of shooed my friends off and, you know, I unholstered to take a leak. And it was the most astonishing thing in the world because the crust of the earth there where the volcano was erupting maybe was 2 feet thick, very porous. So, you know, my pee immediately soaked right into the ground. There was a brief pause, and then this cloud of urine steam flew up around me. And it was just like the most surprising thing that ever happened to me while urinating. And it was also just cool because there were streams of lava all around us. The air was thick with sulfur smoke, which smelled terrible. But, and I felt like Beelzebub or the devil might appear at any moment. It was really a kind of primordial experience. And also, yes, a primordial pea.
I've asked a lot of questions, and I've also been asked a lot of questions in 200 episodes, but it would take me a while if somebody had asked me what is the craziest experience you've had while peeing, but you've got one right on the ready, so I like it.
That's the story of my life, to make something really great out of something, kind of every day.
Yeah. Yeah. And another thing that you, I know, kind of focus on that I really, really enjoy speaking to people with about is, in your travels, you also really like to experience the cuisine. And I'm huge on, food brings people together. And, I did a whole episode with the guy that created Diners and Drive-Ins and Dives about just how crazy the cuisine in the United States is about mixing everything together. We don't really have our own true cuisine. So I just love talking about, kind of that. And I, in my travels, I've dealt with that a lot where, I've traveled solo several times and just being invited, to sit with people and learn about cuisine. I think that's a huge thing, a huge long-winded question of just asking about some of your favorite cuisine you've had while traveling.
Yeah. So one time I was in Fort Myers, near Fort Myers, visiting a buddy of mine who is the novelist Randy Wayne White. He publishes a series of books called Doc Watson, I believe. It's Doc something. Anyway, so I was there with Randy, and he said, "Do you want to go get some oysters?" And I was like, "I love oysters. Sure, I'd love to do that." And he said, "No, do you want to go out in my boat and get some oysters?" So we put together, all of our snorkeling gear, went out onto the bay outside of Fort Myers, and he has some favorite oystering places. And the oysters tend to grow near the mangroves because they find good places for them to attach. So, we took his motorboat out. He sent me over the edge. And with a hammer and a pry bar, which, did a good job of dragging me to the bottom of the ocean, kind of troubling. But I was able to dislodge a chunk of oysters that was about the size of my head, and bring it back up to the surface. Randy hoisted me back up over the gunwales of the boat, and we spent 45 minutes hammering away at the oysters and cracking them open with the oyster cracker. And believe me, those squirmy, fresh, live oysters in that boat, he brought cocktail sauce and lemon to squeeze on them. It was about the most delicious thing I've ever eaten, were those oysters straight from the ocean bottom. But that's just one of my food tales. I'm a major chow hound. I love to eat. So it's kind of amazing that I don't weigh 300 pounds, but I'm grateful that I don't.
Mm. That could have been a perfect little bow tie where you just talked about going to the bathroom by a volcano. We're talking about oysters. You live in Colorado. I thought this was going to be oysters of the Rocky Mountain variety.
No, I've never had Rocky Mountain oysters, but I'm a carnivore. I eat all kinds of things. The idea of eating bull testicles does not appeal. So I think that, there are only two foods that I try to avoid: bull testicles, successful so far, and okra. I like it in gumbo, but that's about the only way. So every other food, I'm for it. Testicles, okra, forget it.
I'm with you with the okra, and I can eat it in gumbo too. I was just in New Orleans, and I can handle it in a gumbo, but yeah, I'm not an okra fan. The only food I try to avoid is olives. I hate that like the plague. I'd eat anything else. I actually have had Rocky Mountain oysters and breaded and dipped in cocktail sauce. It's pretty good. So you can try it.
Yeah. Even okra tastes good fried. So
yeah,
testicles do too.
They certainly do. Let's kind of cover. Let's get into. I told you not to mention some of the interesting people that have you've dealt with on your travels, and two of those people. One was Matt Damon. I think that you were doing. I don't know whether it was during your men's health time or whether it was Barack Obama that you were dealing with during that time. But talk about both of those stories. Just throwing out that you. You either traveled or did a piece on Matt Damon and Barack Obama is not nothing.
Yeah, it was two of the cool things that have happened to me in my life. Yeah, so with Matt Damon, it was I was the editor of Men's Health magazine, and so I would be fielding a certain amount of phone calls from press people, et cetera, making proposals as to who we should put on the cover of the magazine. And one day, this guy from LA called up and said, "You know, hey Peter, we were wondering if you would like to travel to India to do a cover story for Men's Health on Matt Damon." And we had never put Matt on the cover of Men's Health. He's obviously a guy who a lot of guys admire, including me. So it didn't take a long time for me to say, let's see now, do I want to go to India with Matt Damon? The answer was yes. I went through a whole rigmarole because I was in kind of a hurry to pick up my visa to be able to fly to India. So, you know, I actually had to sneak into the Indian consulate in New York. I was at the end of a line of 300 people getting visas one day, and I was pretty sure I wasn't going to make it to the front of that line. So I had the bright idea to go in the back door of the building where the consulate was, walk up 8 floors to where the Indian consulate was located at that time, and knock on the door, the back door of the consulate. And somebody opened it and said, "Yeah." And I said, "Yeah, I need to come in." So I walked in, I cut the line of 300 people, got my visa stamped, and 2 days later, I was flying to India. And I eventually ended up in Mumbai, which is in southern India. In Chennai in southern India. And I walked into the cafeteria in this hotel. And, you know, somehow you just don't expect to walk into the cafeteria and see Matt Damon sitting there. He waves me over, super friendly guy. And we spend a week traveling around to visit places that his charity, water.org, was servicing. So it was super cool to be, you know, obviously hanging with Matt. He's a natural storyteller. People, I guess I must have at least some resemblance to Matt Damon, because people thought I was his brother traveling with him, obviously his older brother. But it was just one of those kind of amazing experiences, getting to know somebody who's very much in the public eye. You know, I was more used to seeing him as Jason Bourne than I was as my travel companion. But, you know, there are benefits to traveling with Matt Damon, and it gets you in some places that you wouldn't get into otherwise.
Sure. And I feel like traveling, it's either would be easier or harder with someone like that, especially in India, where I feel like you can be Matt Damon or you can be Joe Schmo. But, you know, the Indian people really like to meet Caucasian people from America. So it's kind of an interesting thing where you're famous regardless. So I feel like you would have gotten some stares regardless of who you were with. So you're like, Is this because it's Matt Damon or is it because I'm here?
Yeah, I was co-famous with Matt Damon for exactly 1 week. You know, then we resumed our normal lives, and, you know, and I'm nobody and he's somebody, but he was a great guy. His charity, water.org, is an amazing one and is bringing water to people all over the world. You know, it's a crucial element for life. And, you know, I give Matt a ton of credit for throwing himself in on that.
Yeah. While you were talking, I typed in Matt Damon. I get, hopefully, maybe I'll interview him sometime, and this will make him upset, but I always get him and Mark Wahlberg confused. They're back and forth to me, but yeah, I know who Matt Damon is. Somebody I don't confuse with somebody else. Talk about how you, something with Barack Obama.
Yeah, so I was, you know, again, this is during my Men's Health days, and I was sitting at my desk. I was preparing to go out for a run that day at lunch, because exercise is mandatory if you work for Men's Health magazine. So I just thought, well, why don't I just send an email off to the White House press office proposing Barack Obama for the cover of Men's Health? Obviously, super fit guy. He was a candidate for president at that time. I knew that he was having trouble finding men who would vote for him. Women were all over Barack Obama, but men were like, nah, maybe not. So I made the pitch. Men's Health goes out to 20 million men in the U.S., is read by 20 million men in the U.S. Every month. President or candidate Obama is a physically fit guy. He kind of belongs on the cover of Men's Health. And, you know, so I went out for my run. I sent off the email, went out for my run, came back, and there was an immediate response saying, oh, yeah, absolutely. We want him to be on the cover of Men's Health. Then a couple of years later, it was Obamacare was much in the news at that point. People were debating healthcare a lot. And I thought, this is a great moment. This is a great opportunity for me to repitch the president. Again, the White House responded immediately and they added a cherry on top. They said, well, you guys do women's health, right? I said, yeah. And they said, well, do you want to talk to Michelle Obama too? So in the course of 2 weeks, one summer, you know, I went to the White House twice, once to talk to the president and the second time to talk to the first lady. And I was like pinching myself the whole time. It's like, don't they know who I am? But they invited me anyway because I worked for a big magazine. And it was, you know, among the most treasured memories of my journalism career.
That's awesome. Yeah. Don't they know who you are? You're Matt Damon's brother, right?
Yeah, my brother with a different name and a different mother, but yeah, that's right.
Well, that's cool. What was that like? I mean, you obviously it was a surreal experience, but how much time did you get? What were you talking about with both of them?
Yeah, so I interviewed the president first, and you know, I spent about an hour sweating in a park across from the White House, thinking, I can't believe I'm going in there to talk to the president of the United States. I mean, I've interviewed a ton of celebrities in my life, but nobody's a celebrity like the president is. So I walked up to the, you know, those little guardhouses that you see on the West Wing and said, I'm here for a meeting with the president. They took my name. Ah, yes. Head right in, Mr. Moore. So I spent some time hanging out in the press room. They finally called me upstairs and I was hanging out with the president's press aides. And, you know, finally the phone rang, you know, we're ready for Peter now. And I got up from the desk where I was sitting and looked down this very long hallway in the White House. You know, it was lined with portraits of presidents and busts of important people. But way down at the end of the hallway, I could see this lanky black man leaning against, a desk and talking with the staff members there. And it was just like, it was a view I never expected to have with, you know, Barack Obama directly in front of me. And I was walking arduously, took forever to walk down this long hallway. But the president stood up, shook my hand and said, nice to see you again. Meaning that his aides had prepped him for the fact that I had already spoken during his campaign. So, you know, I was returnee to Barack Obama, but having the president walk ahead of you and throw open the door to the Oval Office was just like a room I never expected to find myself in. They showed me to a chair, you know that chair where like the ambassador sits when he's talking to the president? That was the chair I was in. And I remember looking at the president's face, and right over him was one of those fancy grandfather clocks that they have in the Oval Office. And I thought, oh my God, I need to make the most of my time here. So I probably had 20 minutes with the president, which, you know, given that he's president for 4 years at a time, that's actually quite a long time for me. And I was loaded up with questions about healthcare in the U.S., his own personal experience of it, his experience with his mom, and what he hoped Obamacare would mean to the men who read Men's Health. Depending on how you feel about Barack Obama, it wouldn't surprise a lot of people to hear that he was super thoughtful and gracious answering my questions. We talked a little bit about his own wrestling match with being a smoker and how hard it is to quit that and the sympathy that he has for people who are trying to do that. And in general, just realizing that health is a fraught subject for so many people, especially in our country. And he was trying to do something about it. So it was an amazing time. I had to get home and bang out the cover story in a couple of days, which was a challenge. But, you know, I also had a lot of fresh memories of how cool it was to be sitting in the Oval Office with Barack Obama.
For sure. Did you get any pictures? Or you had any many memories other than in your mind?
Yeah, I've got a photo. It's not nearby here. I could hold it up for you.
Right.
But, you know, a picture of me sitting, looking kind of like amazed with the president gesturing in mid conversation. And I've got that photo up in my living room framed with a photo of Michelle Obama with her arm around me. And it's not just that she had her arm around me, she was kind of digging her hand into my right hip. So you can see like where the shirt is creased. And I thought, Well, I made a good impression on the first lady because she was giving me a major side hug there.
Yeah, I love that. Are you at all involved with men's health anymore?
I do a piece for them occasionally. They threw me out in 2015 because I was making too much money. I was the editor. They were having budgetary problems. So that was it for me. But I was ready to leave men's health at that time anyway. I had worked there for 20 years at the point that they let me go. And, you know, I had other adventures in life that I had to go pursue. So thank you very much, Men's Health. I'm out of here. And so I was.
I was just wondering if they're going to be putting our current president on the cover for health reasons, huh?
Yeah, it would be a whole different story with President Trump, for sure. Yeah, all sorts of mental and physical health things that we could explore with him. But from what I understand it, at least he doesn't drink alcohol. So so that's one health benefit in his favor.
Yeah, no, that's true. And I'm not surprised to hear the thoughtfulness of President Obama. You know, I talked to a guy that was was in the White House press corps and through like four presidents. And regardless of what people's political opinions are, you know, he had been from HW all the way through Trump. And, you know, it's no question that Obama is probably the most thoughtful, whether you agree with any of his thoughts. That's another thing entirely. Yeah, let's talk about let's kind of go into a little bit more about your travel and how it coincides with journalism. Just because I want to ask you, given that you've done a lot of travel for pieces and traveling where you then had to write a story about it, do you think that has helped your travel experiences or hurt it? I can see it both ways where, you know, it really makes you notice every little thing because you know you're going to have to write about it again. Or the other side of, I can't just sit back and enjoy things because I've got to think of how does this work for my story? Is this going to fit into my piece? Talk a little bit about kind of coming to terms with getting to travel, but also having to document it.
Well, you know, I do a lot of travel that I'm not writing about as well. So, you know, I've sat in many beautiful places, drinking a margarita, thinking, I am so glad not to be working now. But it almost, you know, it's an echo of what I was talking about with Long's Peak, in the sense that there's a certain level of anxiety that I have whenever I have a story that I have to write. So that makes me prepare for a trip in a whole different way. Meaning I'm seeking out sources beforehand, asking what's important about the trip. I'm going to be talking about two other people who've taken the same trip that I have, so they can give me any tips that they might have. And then when I'm on the trip, you know, I'm a walking eyeball. It's like, I'll talk to anybody. I want to get a ton of perspectives. You never know who's going to share an anecdote with you that is going to work perfectly for the lead of a story. So it's a different kind of reconnaissance that I do before I'm writing a travel piece than I would do when it's just, you know, my wife and me cruising on the Danube. You know, we went on a cruise last September down the Danube from Budapest, finally made it to Istanbul. And that was more about, you know, the food on the ship, the wine steward with his endless pours, the cool people that we met on board, and plus being in a part of the world I'd never been to. So that is a very relaxing thing for me, as opposed to if I'm doing a story, I really want to nail all the details so that I can bring them back to people who will be reading about for me and make the destination vivid. And I'm used to processing things through my writing. I've been a journal keeper my whole adult life, 6 million words worth. So I'm always documenting everything that's going on in my life. And when I'm doing travel journalism, it's just heightened because I'm bringing it out to an audience that with any luck will want to know what I've done.
Yeah, we talked about obviously some of the big pieces that you've done, you know, interviewing the president, traveling with Matt Damon, going to Nepal, all of these things I'm sure got a lot of eyeballs just because of, you know, they're major pieces with major players involved. But I always like to ask people, you know, that to do something artistic. What's your favorite thing that you've done that maybe didn't get the recognition that you felt like it deserved? You spent a lot of time, whether it was thinking about it or you spent a lot of time researching it, spent a lot of times in your travel, and it just doesn't, you're really proud of it, but maybe very few people saw it.
Well, you know, I don't know if this perfectly fits in the category you're talking about, but probably 3 or 4 years ago, I made a transition to adding artwork to what I do, meaning sketches, drawings, cartoons. And at that time, I pitched Backpacker on a story called The Best 0.7 Ounce Addition to Your Hiking Gear. And of course, that 0.7 ounces was a pencil. And in that story, I talked about how, as I developed my skills as an artist, how bringing artistic materials, pencils, watercolors, paper, my iPad and iPencil, how those things, incorporating those into my travel kit has made a huge difference about what kind of traveler I am. Because, you know, I tend to, you know, you go to Nepal and you're on a trek and every day you're moving through, you know, 10 miles on the trek and it's like being bombarded with sensation. As opposed to when I go on a hike now and I have my, you know, I have a pencil and paper with me, I'll find that comfortable log to sit on in front of an amazing view and document it. So that I'm sitting there, you know, could be for 15 minutes, could be for an hour, depending on how complicated the drawing is, to really take in what I'm seeing and filter it through my own artwork. And I feel like it's kind of an underappreciated travel technique is to go someplace and draw it. And the first time I ever saw anybody do that was I was on a it was a family wedding, and my sister-in-law brought her little watercolor kit and was seated in this really cool town square in San Antonio, rendering it in watercolor. And I think that moment, looking over her shoulder and seeing how she was filtering this amazing city scene in front of her, I thought, I want to do that. And it launched me in a whole different direction in my career, which has been super gratifying. And also, I feel like it's improved me as a traveler as well.
I like that a lot. And you've kind of incorporated my next question into things. And that is about your if you weren't interesting enough now that you're also a cartoonist, but I want to know a little bit more about what that means. Obviously you got inspired from somebody who was doing watercolor, talked about traveling and drawing what you see, but how exactly do you incorporate that into whether it's your pieces, or I don't know whether it's always you're only drawing when you're also writing, you know, words with it, or whether that's ever just kind of the entire work, or what's that look like?
Well, you know, it's something I'm trying to move into now. And, you know, I was known as a health editor and, you know, the guy who talked to Obama. So it was, I still get a lot of assignments that way, but what I'm trying to do is transition into the ones that, like the backpacker piece, would be not only me writing about the destination I've been to, but would incorporate my drawings into it as well. You know, after I got into this for a little while, a friend of mine recommended that I go on Substack, which are you familiar with the blogging platform Substack? Yeah. So I have a Substack. It's petermoore.substack.com. And I used it as a leverage point for me to show my artwork and my writing at the same point, at the same time. And, you know, I had, like a lot of people, I kind of dribbled along for a couple of years with 100 or 200 subscribers. And, you know, it felt like possibly a waste of time, except for it quickly grew into my travel cartooning portfolio. So I was able to then turn around to, there's a very big online newspaper in Colorado called the Colorado Sun. And based on all the stuff that I'd accumulated in petermoore.substack.com, I was able to say to her, I'm a writer and a cartoonist. You can see my work here. What I want to do is to make fun of living in Colorado for the Colorado Sun. And I, you know, pitched her on a few ideas. She got back to me in a couple of days and said, we would love to have you do this. So the first cartoon I ever did for the Colorado Sun was, there's a major, and at the end of September, there is the time of the elk rut. where the bull elks are gathering together harems of lady elk, impregnating them. They're pregnant all winter, and then they give birth in the spring. And it occurred to me that it was a funny idea to think of all of the tourism that's involved in watching the elk rut is really a massive invasion of privacy if you're an elk. So I did a cartoon based on the idea that it is highly improper for human beings to go watch some other species mate. How would we feel if elk came into our bedrooms and watched us mate? We wouldn't like it. So I did this cartoon for the Colorado Sun. The readers loved it and launched me into my professional career as a cartoonist. And I never did actually, I might've forgotten to mention to the editor who hired me that I had never done anything like this before. But the reader response was immediate and so good that, you know, I'm a cartoonist and columnist for the Colorado Sun. And based on my work there, Front Range NPR, which it's always a big deal to have an NPR gig, hired me as a commentator and animator. So you can see my work on KUNC.org/Peter Moore, where I do funny commentaries on, you know, again, various topics about life in Colorado, but put animations with it, which is, you know, a huge bonus for their social media people, because that's a great way to gain eyeballs and clicks if you can put an animation with what you write. So all that has been a thrill for me, how that's developed. It's been a lot of fun. And really, at this point in my career, I just want to have fun.
I think that's really, really amazing for sure. I feel like I can't help but think there's a joke in there somewhere. If you are a cartoonist for NPR, somebody who's a cartoonist fit for radio, I don't know what that means, right?
Yeah, I am a face fit for radio, and I'm also an animator fit for radio too. But they have a robust website, so lots of people come there to see and listen to my work too.
For sure. So yeah, I feel like you're doing a great job of kind of moving into those next questions, and that the kind of the last one is just, we talked a lot about your career, and it's expansive, but where are you sitting now? It sounds like you do the cartoonist thing for the Colorado Sun, you do the NPR thing. Where's Peter Moore right now?
Well, you know, part of the reason why I launched my Substack was I was trying to convince a book agent to take on an illustrated memoir that I wrote during the COVID time, or began writing during COVID. So really what I would love to do is to maintain these cartooning and drawing and writing gigs while I also launch a series of memoirs that are based on my travels. One of my most popular posts on Substack was a post called Vincent and Me, and it was about a trip that my wife and I took in France, basically chasing Vincent Van Gogh all over the country. Everywhere we went had a Van Gogh angle to it. And I had a funny idea on my Substack, was that I was going to figure out who in Van Gogh's circle actually killed him when he was in Saint-Rémy. It was next stop after that. But so I came to this conclusion that it was his sister-in-law, because she was the one who really made the most money off of Van Gogh's paintings. He never made any. She made a bundle. And I thought, you know, there's nothing as inconvenient as a living artist, because he's going to want to be paid himself. Once he's dead, then he can become one of the all-time greats as Van Gogh did. So it may not seem funny to be writing about Van Gogh's sister-in-law murdering him, but it was, you know, 40,000 people saw that that post I did on Substack, and it really launched me into a whole new realm there.
I think I could ask you questions for at least double the amount of time we've already talked, but no, I really, really appreciate your time. In wrapping things up, shout out anything you want to shout out, whether it's your page on the Sun, whether it's your Substack, just shout out all your connection points.
Yeah, I would love it if people look me up at petermoore.substack.com. All of the work that I do eventually ends up there. So that's the best way to get a look at, a traveling cartoonist. If that such a thing exists, I'm him, and you can see it on Substack.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Peter. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi, it's Peter Moore. Absolutely amazing guy. You know, this was a conversation that I knew what I was getting myself into, but I don't think I knew just how cool it would be. I knew that he was a cartoonist. I knew that he was a writer in the past. I knew that he had traveled to a lot of really, really amazing places. And that was enough for me. And just to hear so much more, I guess I kind of knew that he had some kind of connection with Matt Damon and with Barack Obama. I don't think that I knew just how cool it was. I don't think I knew that he was the editor of Men's Health Magazine. That's pretty awesome. I think I just kind of glazed over that apparently, but that makes this interview even more amazing. I think you can hear my excitement just in listening, and talking with Peter. I couldn't even imagine what it would be like to drive up to the White House and say, I'm here for my interview with the president. That would be quite the undertaking for sure. I'm sure that went really, really awesome. Peter is an amazing, amazing guy. Go check out all of his links. I know that he's got a Substack, all that kind of stuff. The links to all things Peter Moore will be in the show notes. If this is your first time listening or you haven't already, go leave a 5-star rating on Apple or Spotify. Leave a written review on Apple. Helps a ton. Go follow along on Instagram and on TikTok, Not Enough Podcast, Not Enough with Jackson Enough on Facebook, all those places. But we'll see you next week. Take it away, Chris.
This has been Not in a Huff with Jackson Huff. Thank you for listening. Be sure to join us next time where we will interview another amazing guest who is sure to make you laugh or make you think. Or, hey, maybe even both. But until then, keep being awesome.